It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We love cats. We love to keep them as pets. 74 to 96 million cats are pets in the United States. And more than anything, it seems we love to look at pictures and videos of them on the internet. This hour, we're going to talk about cats. My guest is Abigail Tucker. She is correspondent for Smithsonian Magazine, and she's author of The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. Hello, Abigail.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And first, give us a little bit of your history with cats. You don't come into this subject as an entirely impartial observer.
Sadly, I can't say that I do. I've always been part of a cat-owning, cat-loving family, and as far as I can tell, that's an ancestral trait. I grew up with cats, my mom grew up with cats, and they're just an animal that's got a lot of personal appeal for me. And one of the challenges of this book was to kind of take this very familiar and charming little creature and hold it at arm's length a little bit more and to kind of think about it in a little bit more of an objective way. That was my goal, anyway.
Well, and in the interest of full disclosure, I also live with 8 cats right now. And we can talk about how your book changed my feelings over the course of reading it later this hour. But first, let's look back, because that's where you start. And as a science writer, I mean, you took a good in-depth look back in time as far as we can actually see. And let's talk first about the genetics of the house cats that we live with. I mean, what can we learn from kind of looking at their genetics and comparing them to wild cats?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because we actually know a lot about what house cats are and the animals that they derive from, because that animal, Felis sylvestris libica, the house cat's closest relative, is still alive and well in the Near East today. And it's interesting because we can look at those animals and our present house pets and kind of compare their genetics and see the ways in which they differ a little bit. And that's very different than with dogs, because domestic dogs that we have around us today are so far removed from any kind of wild relation that there's a huge amount of scientific debate about what kind of wolves dogs came from and when and where this happened. With cats, it's a lot more clear cut. And it's interesting because superficially, at least, house cats resemble their wild kin very closely, to the extent that people, even experts, can't tell from a distance, you know, whether an animal that you're seeing running around in Turkey is a domestic cat or a wild Felis sylvestris libica. They haven't changed too much on the surface, but internally they've changed a little bit more. House cats have diminished fear systems in their brains, which is one characteristic of a domestic animal. So house cats, one way to think about it is that house cats have undergone the mysterious process of domestication to a partial degree. And a lot of that, what matters is stuff on the inside. They look very much like their wild relatives, but they act differently and they're wired differently.
All right, so their brains are smaller than their wild counterparts. They are less afraid of humans, which obviously is an advantage to both humans.
Huge.
And
yep.
Cats. What are some of the other differences that we know about?
Another thing is that their intestines are a little bit longer, and scientists think that may, even though all cats, including house cats, are strict hypercarnivores, and I hope that's something we'll get to talk about more later. Cats just eat huge amounts of meat, and it's sort of the staple of their diet. They can eat a little bit bigger variety of protein forms, which may
like Doritos.
Be why.
Wait,
exactly,
no.
Like Doritos.
Those aren't protein forms.
Yeah. I know, right? They here and there they cheat on their diets when they're with humans, but yeah, they have most cats have very short guts, and house cats have a little bit longer intestines because it helps them digest things more. And then another interesting thing is that house cats are, they're just I guess one of their supreme characteristics is that they're adaptable animals, and they have they're very adaptable in terms of their social lives. Felis silvestris libica in the wild is like the vast majority of wild cats. It's an asocial, solitary animal, whereas house cats can live solo in the wild and be kind of the king of a large tract of territory, but they can also live in family groups a little bit more like lion prides. So they have adapted their social lives too. So physically, though, there's not that many characteristics that are different than the wild form of the cat. House cats do things like meow a little bit more than wild cats. These wild cats are pretty much silent animals because they're all by themselves and they don't really have anybody to talk to. But house cats have learned to meow a little bit more, although it does seem that the meows are not directed so much at their feline housemates, but more at us. It's a way that they've kind of developed to sort of condition humans to do what they want. So they have tweaked their physique in a couple of different ways, and they look a little bit different than wild cats in that they have things like spots on their fur, like big white blotches on their noses, on their bellies, on their backs, a few other superficial characteristics like that. And these are part of a suite of characteristics that scientists call the domestication syndrome, which you see across different kinds of domesticated animals, from cows to even farmed fish like carp. They have these weird it's hard to know what to call them, but they have a lot of these white spots on their fur, but they also have a lot of domesticated animals have traits that cats don't have. Like you'll see a lot of farm animals and types of dogs with things like floppy ears, and that's as Charles Darwin noted, that's something that you don't see in wild animals except for elephants. And they've got weird cartilage in their tails a lot, but cats don't have floppy ears, and they don't, by and large, have curly tails. And this scientists take as a sign that perhaps their domestication process is still kind of underway, whereas in other animals, we kind of took Right. them into our care, and they became domesticated over a few hundred years. Cats have been in our company for thousands of years, and people argue that they're still not fully domesticated.
Well, and this is so interesting. That comparison is fascinating because, as you point out, it opens the question of who is driving this process of domestication. Because when we look at dogs, we domesticated dogs, and we have bred dogs for different purposes. They work with us in many different parts of life. Of course, we love them as companions. With cats, there is an open question of whether we domesticated cats or whether cats decided to live with us.
Exactly. Yes, that's a really interesting concept, and not something I'd really kind of thought about too much. I, as someone who grew up with cats, I just sort of pictured them as part of the natural landscape and something that had always been around. But in fact, you know, we can go back to archaeological sites from 10 or 11,000 years ago in the Near East and see the kind of places where these wild little cats first started to kind of sidle up to us. One of the things that I had the privilege to do when reporting the book was to visit the lab of a Smithsonian scientist named Melinda Zader, who was sorting through the remains of a Neolithic village called Halan Temi, where it was one of these places where humans were first transitioning from hunter-gathering societies to more sedentary societies, where they'd be living in the same place all year, and they were kind of starting to alter the environment in different ways. And one of the things that they were doing was leaving around huge piles of meaty trash, basically. They were not farming grain at the time, but they were hunting a lot of animals, leaving big piles of rotting food around, and then they were also killing off the big threatening predators in the area. And these two factors together caused a spike in what scientists call mesopredators, these little mid-sized predators, things like foxes and badgers and wildcats, which were drawn in by the trash and also by the fact that humans kind of offered them protection from some of these wild beasts that would have been their predators, things like leopards. And so we created this niche that these little animals started to ply, basically. But what's interesting is that, you know, even though we have things like foxes and raccoons in human cities today in large numbers.
And they're still opportunistic. And
exactly. Yeah.
Use human trash, et cetera. But
that's the same old. But none of them have seemed to have gone the extra mile and done what house cats did, which is undergo an actual domestication process. And it may be that they certain ones of these wild cats, which got into our garbage and started, having evolutionary success because of that. They, you know, they had more protection. They had more food, which meant they could have healthier babies. They started, having these degrees of unheard of success. And it could be that just this process began to favor the boldest wildcats and the ones that had sort of natural personality traits that over time they just kind of selected themselves to become bolder and bolder and bolder. And it's not that they were necessarily tame or docile or meek. It's that they were sort of lion-hearted little guys. And they were able to take advantage of us more completely with with each successive generation. And I also think, so that's sort of the cat half of it. They were sort of raiding our settlements in a way. And then I also think that there's certain characteristics about humans that led us to be particularly susceptible to these cats.
We will talk about those characteristics in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest right now is Abigail Tucker. She is the author of the new book, The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. We will continue our conversation in a moment. But also a little later in the hour, Mick McAuliffe of the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines is going to join us as we try to decode some puzzling cat behavior that many of us, obviously millions of us, live with. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about cats. My guest is Abigail Tucker. She's a correspondent for Smithsonian Magazine and the author of The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. And just before the break, we were talking about how we're not really sure who's driving the bus on cat domestication. It doesn't seem to be humans, as it is with so many other domestic animals. It could be that cats were opportunists who found that living with humans was very positive for them, and that domestication process took place over a long period of time. And Abigail, before the break, you were saying that there are things about humans that make them susceptible to this relationship with cats. But before we get into that, I want to talk about benefits of cats, because I'm sure there are a lot of people thinking, well, you know, yeah, dogs do all these things for people, but it's pretty obvious what cats do. They control vermin. And you looked into that pretty deeply. Is there a lot of evidence for cats actually doing that job?
Well, I mean, look, all of us who have cats have seen what amazing hunters that they are. And, you know, whether my recent cats have been indoor cats, and they still have managed to catch mice in various apartments of mine. And, you know, they're just these exquisite hunters and can catch all kinds of prey animals, from butterflies to lemurs. But I think it's sort of the idea that cats can make any kind of a dent in a commensal rodent population, like a house mouse or a particularly a street rat population, is a little bit misguided. Scientists have studied the impacts of cats, the presence of feral cats and alley cats in alleyways in Baltimore, and have seen that cats hardly ever will try to tackle these Norway rats that are our dominant street rat species. And, you know, who can really blame them? Norway rats are these really big, fearsome, disease-ridden animals that could, you know, go toe-to-toe with a little cat in a lot of cases. And why would they bother fighting with each other when there's so much trash around in these alleyways for everybody to eat? There's plenty to go around. And, you know, I think, you know, reporting this book, I was just amazed and struck by the mightiness of this little feline species that we hardly think of, that, you know, just lives in all of our houses. But I was also struck by how amazing and mighty animals like rats and mice are. They're just so numerous, so good at breeding, so good at hiding, that it's a little misguided to think that cats can operate as any kind of effective rodent control, especially in a citywide context. And, you know, I want to assure listeners that I really did sort of try to look everywhere I could for the silver lining in this part of the cat-human relationship. And I'd heard that, well, you know, if cats can't really keep down large populations of rodents, maybe they can at least keep a couple of them out of our houses and protect us. If they can, you know, if they don't protect our food stores necessarily and our farms from rodents, maybe they can protect us from rodent-borne diseases, which are a huge problem. And so I made a good faith effort to check out that information. And it turns out that, you know, cats actually, when they, in the rare occasions when they do kill one of these rats or rodents, they're very frequently pick up the diseases that these rodents carry, like plague, for instance. Something like 10% of the cases of plague in the American Midwest, or the Rocky Mountain areas, I should say, that in modern history have been spread to people directly from cats. And so it's just like one of these fascinating things where we kind of make up these stories for ourselves about why we keep these animals around, because we don't really understand why we keep them around. And I don't think that, they certainly don't earn their keep in the way that a rat terrier or something like that would. And there have been these cases, particularly in Australia, where people have loosed house cats for a specific purpose, like, you know, we're going to get rid of all these invasive rabbits. Go, cats, go, do it now. And they usually end in great disappointment for the humans, because usually the invasive rodent or rabbit species ends up fine, and cats end up eating all kinds of things that they weren't supposed to eat in the first place.
Because the native smaller species are easier or more fun to kill for cats, perhaps. So let's talk about what makes, if it's not to control our rodent population, why do we live with these little demanding creatures, do you think?
Yes, right. Because if I do think that, you know, if circumstances were a little bit different, we're good at repelling all kinds of creatures from the human sphere. And I do think that if cats were a little less irresistible to us in terms of their aesthetics, then this story would be very different. But it turns out that cats have this very specific set of facial features and really whole body features that are what scientists have sometimes called baby releasers. They're sets of physical features that remind us of human infants, and they kind of prime us to care for them in a really interesting way. And it's especially fascinating because the feline features that, you know, we would call baby releasers, these really large eyes that are planted right in the middle of the face, a little snub nose, and a kind of cute little round face, all of these things are not a sign that cats are closely related to us or our babies at all. They're all part of the feline hunting arsenal. You know, cats have big eyes in the middle of their face because they're ambush predators that jump out of hidden places to tackle their prey. They have small noses because they're not olfactory predators that sniff after their prey for a long time. They don't use smell in hunting as much as dogs do. And they have these round faces because they have these short, powerful jaws that are meant to grip in that first, you know, tackle and kill ambush moment. So these, just by a happy accident, these faces look a lot like the faces of human children. And, you know, that's something that if you looked at Felis sylvestris libica, the face of that cat is very similar to our domestic cats. They haven't really changed that much. This is just a big lucky break for house cats, because I do think that is one of the characteristics that have given them the edge over other animals that are cute but not as cute, like foxes.
All right, so it's that face. They're just so adorable. So they are releasing oxytocin in our bodies. They're making us feel love. That's a benefit, right?
Exactly. They prime us to feel these emotions, and then there's even evidence that they kind of work the system even more. In the cat's purr, which I don't know if you've had this sort of zombie-like experience where a cat will be sitting near you and will be purring and everything will be fine, but suddenly you feel moved to get up and open a can of food and put it down for the cat. And that's because inside of their sweet purr, cats have learned to sort of embed this insistent cry for food that's a little bit like a human baby's cry. And we can't really hear it, but it's still kind of works on us, and we get up and do its bidding. And there's other things too about cats
that frequency that cats can meow at. I found after I had kids that my cats were waking me up all the time in the middle of the night because their meows sounded like one of my kids making noises. And I had one cat in particular that I do think used that all the time.
Yeah. No, and I think that just other things too, just the size of an average house cat. I mean, I will confess that I've had some chubby, plump house cats that are way over the average weight, but something like they're like 8 pounds, something like that. That's very much the size of a human neonate. And I think that just the weight of a cat in your arms and stuff, it's a priming experience in some way.
Yeah, very comforting and cozy. But that's not just
yeah, and I think these things have become more important over the last, 100 years or so, since we've sort of more formally taken cats into our houses as pets. You know, before that, cats were a lot more kind of on the periphery, and we didn't chase them away. And I think that it might be because we found them to be beautiful in a way that was hard for us to put our finger on why. But now I think this idea of feline aesthetics and the power that they have, especially on the internet, it's just becoming more and more clear that there's something very strange at work.
I'm talking with Abigail Tucker. Her book is The Lion in the Living Room: How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. Okay, so we have this relationship with cats. We seem to be very susceptible to them. We also have moved forward in our relationship with cats. More and more people have them all over the world. But we also are doing something that's fairly new, and that is keeping them inside all the time. So how has that changed our relationship with cats? That's created some new challenges.
Yeah, that was one of the things that struck me in the reporting of the book, that even though this is a relationship that's been ongoing for 10,000 years, it's not a static thing. It's something that's been changing rapidly. And I was startled to read a statistic that up until the 1960s, people were still spending considerably more money on provisioning things like pet birds and pet hamsters than pet cats, because cats were almost across the board at least partially outdoor animals, a lot of times fully outdoor animals that were kind of living in association with us, but not necessarily locked in our houses all the time. But since then, things have happened that have been, in one sense, really good for feline populations. The world has become more densely urban, and more than half of the world's population lives in cities now, and urban spaces are in a way more conducive to cats as pets than dogs, because it's small spaces, you're living in an apartment, it's hard to get down to the dog park every couple of hours. And, you know, it just seems like they're a really convenient animal to have in these realms. But they're actually, the transition into fully indoor life has been a little bit more jarring for our feline companions than we'd like to realize. And there have been interesting studies about how a lot of them are, even though they are at least partially domesticated animals, that this transition to full indoor life has been more stressful than they can bear. And they it's a stretch to call them psychological problems, but it's traumatic for them to be trapped inside all the time with no control over their environment, because what cats are at their core are sort of solitary, hypercarnivorous apex predators who are used to kind of being king of the castle, and then they find themselves like locked in a studio apartment with a random person with no way to kind of exercise control over their environment, and that's really hard. So even though it's been a boost to popularity of cats, it's I think people are still kind of struggling to understand that they need to do perhaps more to amplify the environment of their cats and to take their cats into consideration when they're designing their interior worlds than we necessarily would have thought 50 years ago.
Well, and it's an interesting development on a lot of levels, because you can see similarities with problems that other animals that are kept in captivity have. It also creates a lot of the behavior problems that lead to problems that then cats encounter, as people don't want to keep them anymore or struggle with keeping them. Before we get to the next break, though, I want to talk about outdoor cats, or even indoor outdoor cats, because as we've mentioned, I mean, they are incredible hunters and they live everywhere in the world. And this has created a lot of really difficult problems, because there are a lot of people who see them as an invasive species. They actually threaten endangered species.
Yes, this is a very controversial issue, and it's an unusual issue because it's the people on both sides of the debate are very much animal lovers. On one side, you have a lot of people who are especially interested in wild bird populations and the natural world, and then on the other side, often you'll have people who are just very into cats and animal cruelty issues, and it's just something where everybody shares a sensibility but have very different points of view about what it means that we have these animals that are native to the Near East, but because of human expansion patterns have spread to literally everywhere in the world. Lions used to be the most widespread animals on the planet, and now actually the tables have turned, and it's the little house cat, which is really interesting, and I'm just fascinated by, in the book I tried to trace the pathways of how cats spread to absolutely everywhere on the planet. And I think what's clear at this point is that, especially on islands, cats are devastating invasive predators and can single-handedly wipe out populations of birds, especially flightless birds and these birds that don't breed very frequently. Islands are different than mainlands, and they have sometimes simplified ecosystems. A lot of times they won't have even any native mammals, let alone native hypercarnivores. The animals there have this feature known as island tameness, where they just don't know how to escape from a predator, let alone something as cunning and masterful at hunting as felines are. It gets a little bit murkier when you get to big areas like the mainland of America. There have been these studies that show, by attaching cameras to cats, that cats are killing, outdoor cats, are constantly killing things, but it's a little bit harder to show that they're actually driving animals to extinction on mainlands. I think an interesting middle ground is is Australia, because Australia is an island. It's also a vast, vast territory of land, and scientists there are aghast at the amount of havoc that domestic cats have wreaked, and they continue to harry various indigenous animals to extinction. And so it's kind of on the one hand, Australia is an exceptional environment. It's got a lot of indigenous animals, especially marsupials, that are susceptible to cats and also cat-borne diseases like toxoplasmosis. But, you know, it is a huge, harsh wilderness, and cats are able to thrive there in all kinds of different environments. So I think that it's, you know, it's a fascinating issue, and, you know, people on both sides make really good points.
We're talking about cats this hour. My guest is Abigail Tucker. She's the author of The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment. We're also going to bring Mick McAuliffe of the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines into the conversation. We'll talk more about cat behaviors. And, of course, I know a lot of people have cat behavior issues, cat behavior questions. You're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Abigail Tucker. She's the author of The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. We're talking about the domestication process that house cats have gone through over 1,000 years or so, and some of the very interesting discoveries we've made about cats in recent years. Also, some of the challenges that we have with large cat populations. We'll also talk about cat behavior, and you're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mick McAuliffe is joining us now from the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines. Hello, Mick. Hi, Mick. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And is Abigail still there? Good morning,
yes,
Abigail,
she is.
And all the listeners. Yeah.
Well, good morning.
And, we and were just Australian, yes.
We were just talking about, and Iowan as well, but we were just talking before the break about cat populations, outdoor cat populations, and the toll that that can take on native creatures in an environment. We also, of course, in Iowa have many, many barn cats, and that's been an issue that's been of concern to a lot of people in Iowa over recent years, not just because of predation of those cats on local wildlife, but also the welfare of those cats. And Mick, from your perspective, what do you think is changing in how people have cats, live with cats in rural areas in Iowa?
In rural areas, it's unfortunately, there's still many. And what I say is unfortunately is the spay-neuter. You know, we have a per project program, which we offer low-cost spay-neuter for our barn cats program so they can maintain their levels and numbers and communities without growing and doing more harm, or and also teaching people how to care for their cats in the rural areas and in their barn programs, so they have a tendency to be well fed and cared for, so minimizing any impact that may be outside their own area.
And a lot of people are involved in capture, neuter, release programs. A lot of people who want to care for cats and also want to lessen the impact of cats on the environment. And Abigail, you looked into these programs. You talked to people who were involved in them, all incredibly well-meaning people who are working really hard to make a difference. The science on these programs isn't showing a lot of impact yet, at least, is it?
Yeah, it's again, this is one of these issues where people are just passionately divided, and I think people just really want to do something to alleviate the suffering that they see outside their doors, especially with these animals, which are fixtures in our households. It's kind of strange to have your cosseted Siamese inside of your house, and then outside you see these animals that may look like they're suffering. And, you know, I talk to both sides, the people who say that trap neuter release doesn't really work unless you trap a huge number, something like 90% of the cats in the population, and really kind of keep on. You can't just go out for one day and trap and neuter and release cats. You have to have a constant vigil over these communities of cats. Some people say that that just doesn't work, but then, you know, people will, you know, the people who are do trap neuter return or trap neuter release will say, well, you know, euthanasia doesn't work either. And so I kind of was surprised to hear that perspective, but it does kind of make sense to me. I read these fascinating scientific papers about what it takes to remove a population of non-native cats from a deserted island in the middle of the Indian Ocean or the subarctic zone, and the amount of time and energy and money and weaponry and in some cases bio warfare that it takes to remove these animals is staggering. And so I began to think that, yeah, both sides are right. Neither of these solutions are perfect. And, you know, I think people are talking more about, trying to use the two methods together, you know, trapping and neutering to a degree and doing, impounding cats or taking them out of the environment in other ways. But I think that the most important thing is that people on both sides of the issue should kind of try to talk to each other a little bit more and, you know, engage in studies of how these colonies of cats on the American mainland, you know, if they are making a huge impact on wildlife populations or not. And the only way to go about that is if there's a little bit more mutual trust between the scientific community and the animal welfare community.
I have kind of a hard time, and Mick, maybe you can shed some light on this as well, though, when people say the research shows that this isn't making any difference at all, I think, you know, for every female cat spayed, that is so many litters of kittens that don't get born. And so at least from an animal welfare standpoint, you know, at least that these are kittens that are not being raised feral and then, you know, receiving no care and no food and no support as domestic animals living in the wild, whether that's in town or, you know, actually in a wilderness area. So that seems like that makes a difference, Mick.
We believe so. And again, I agree with Abigail. Really, everyone needs to work together because it's not a shelter problem or it's not it's a community problem. You know, all these animals are out there because of us humans, not, you know, somebody placed them out there in the first place. So agree, we have to work together. And of course, one less litter is one, you know, thousands upon hundreds of thousands less cats in the future.
Right, they breed very quickly and well.
They do. They're very resilient. And we're finding, too, that then when people are looking after these colonies or communities and not following through with spay-neuter, so we are seeing more cats. So it's a full program. It's not just one person doing one thing. It's a combination of being able to provide the care, the spay-neuter, and, you know, there's, depending on which studies you read, and of course there's lots of studies on both sides of the fence, is that if we take cats out of that colony, then does other cats come in and want to breed because they're new to the colony and so on and so on. So it's something that we all have to work on together and at least try and slow down those populations, definitely.
Let's get to some behavior questions. I promised we'd talk about that. This is a great question from Denise. And Abigail, I know you have a great deal of experience with this. Denise asks, why do cats eat until they throw up?
You know, I actually wish I could tell you that the answer to that. When I was working on the book for the first time in my life, I was working at home. And so I was exposed to my cat instead of just, you know, during the mornings and the evenings, 24 hours a day I was with him. And there it was just his hunger seemed to be totally bottomless. He would chew at my ankles, you know, every 10 minutes. And so I could give him a few little shakes of food and it never seemed to be quite enough. I'm not sure why that is, but feline obesity is something that I learned a little bit about when I was writing the book, I visited a veterinary hospital in Tennessee where they specialize in the issue. And, you know, basically, these cats are these superb athletes, which we increasingly have trapped inside of our houses. And eating is kind of what they're built to do, eating and having sex. And we've sort of, by and large, taken away that aspect of their lives as well. And our cats have gotten so fat that recently they threw out the previous feline obesity chart, which I think only went up to about 45% body fat, and instated a new chart that goes up to 70% body fat. And so it's just like cats and their appetites are this, it's something that's central to feline physiology. It's really hard to diet a cat because they need certain amounts of certain chemicals in their diets or else they get really sick really fast. And it's something that I could use some tips on myself. So I don't know if
Mick, you got anything for us? Because cat vomit is something a lot of cat and cat obesity. These are things that a lot of us deal with.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I have four and I don't have that issue. And I do free feed. Some people portion feed. But what I would mention to people that if they can always with a behavioral issue, we always ensure that there's no underlying medical issue first that may be contributing to that ravenous behavior. And then what I would do with a cat like that is actually have multiple feed stations, so smaller amounts, and hoping to add to that exercise somewhat using the natural instincts within the home. If it's a housebound cat, keeping the cat indoors, is we start to channel, I guess, those natural behaviors, natural instincts into things around our home. I've been lucky enough to work in zoo facilities as well, and we're mandated on, in some countries, on what we have to provide for mental stimulation enrichment. Yet our domestic pets don't seem to get that same level of care, and it is part of care. There's physical well-being and there's mental well-being. So that's sort of a broad answer, I guess, and sort of a little
right.
bit.
Well, and I've heard many places and from dog trainers, et cetera, that a lot of times our impulse, of course, is to give love, and we give it in the wrong ways. We'll give them as much food as they ask for, but not as much exercise as they need, that kind of thing. Here's a question from Lisa in Bettendorf. Last night I was petting my cat, who was curled up on my lap. I played with his tail just a bit, not hurting him at all. He just reached over and bit my arm pretty hard, enough to break the skin through my long sleeve shirt. He's done little love bites on my bare skin in the past while I'm petting him, seemingly completely unrelated to any behavior of mine. These love bites are never enough to break the skin. This is the first time he's done a real bite like this to me. We've had him for about a year. He's between 6 and 10 years old. So what is that about, and how can I avoid it in the future aside from not messing with his tail?
That would be the first thing. And to modify, we never fix behavior. We manage and we modify. So the first thing we need to do is, of course, not touch the tail, but we could get him, you know, we need to examine our cats. We need to take care of them, brush them, whatever it may be. And I'd put together a desensitizing program. So either a play reward or a smaller treat reward, and work proximity down to that tail. What it sounds like, and without seeing it and talking more, is the arousal, and then the cat offloads with a bite, or normally they grab first. So watching for changes in body language and cues would be the first thing. If they are getting a little bit aroused, we stop that interaction and redirect that into an appropriate toy, which could be a fishing pole toy. Ping pong balls are really great. So they offload that arousal on something else and not us.
Yeah, I would say that your listeners are not alone here in this. I did some, well, first of all, we know that there's a whole show called My Cat from Hell that's about, you know, cats that have these these sort of inexplicable behavioral problems, and a lot of them are what I've heard called redirected aggression, which is where something stressful is happening to a cat, and you know, they take it out on their owner. And there's a couple of famous cases of this. There was a cat in Seattle named Lux that ended up barricading its family inside of a bedroom, and the dad called 911. on, and the tape of that encounter, the emergency dispatch tape, went viral because it was just so odd thinking that here's this cat that had suddenly kind of gone postal. And I think
right,
that
the
from what
dispatcher said, do you think the cat would attack police? And the
guy said,
definitely.
Yep.
Yeah.
This cat is mad. And I think that, you know, these little guys are, you know, they can cut it in our houses, and they can survive here just as they can survive on, you know, volcano cones and subarctic islands where insects can't live in some cases. They're just really good at surviving, but they get stressed out. And, you know, I think that, you know, people would say too that other accommodations that you can give your cats is like a safe space for the cat, even a whole room where the animal can have its place to rest, and know that this is like a no-go zone for humans, and that if they are just super sick of you, they have some place to retreat to instead of lashing out. And so that's not something that I've done, but I'm really curious. I don't know if any listeners have one of these feline sanctuaries in their homes and how that's turned out for them.
I'd like to jump in there. Yeah. I think every home should have that. Cats need to hide, perch, and scratch. They're the three fundamental things we need to provide every animal in our home. So they have choices. If they're not left with choices, then they're like all of us. We all like choices. We all need time to get away. We all need time to decompress, and so do our animals. So I have that. Like I was saying, I have four cats in my house, and I have multiple areas, multiple litter boxes, more than my cats, of course, more litter boxes than I have cats. But they all have their own areas, and they all have their own, they've got it worked out amongst themselves, including with us, that when they're done, they have their spots to go.
And we're nearly out of time, but, you know, Abigail, I mentioned earlier, I would say how your book made me feel about my eight cats, and I think it's interesting. I felt a little used by the felines, but also, I mean, what an incredible creature house cats are, so incredibly adaptable. What is your takeaway from all of this research that you did when you look at your cat Cheeto and all of the other cats in your life?
Well, I mean, I'd say that, you know, living with these magnificent animals that we think of as commonplace but are actually totally extraordinary is a huge privilege for all of us in a way. And I think that, you know, when I first read these things that I was supposed to do to accommodate my cat's psyches, essentially, I was a little taken aback. But now that I think about it more, you know, it's sort of the least we can do to offer these animals a little spot in our houses where they can have their own sort of realms. And, you know, even though one of the things that I was looking for in the book was a reason to explain the human-cat relationship and sort of what we were getting out of it in return, the reciprocal nature of that relationship, I wasn't really able to find anything that cats gave us other than pleasure. And ultimately, I began to think that that was something really kind of beautiful and pure, that humans, who are such users and, you know, so good at taking advantage of our environment and other animals, are able to have a relationship with this animal without taking too much in return, which I thought was kind of neat.
Abigail Tucker, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Abigail Tucker is the author of The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. Mick McAuliffe, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Mick McAuliffe from the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines. He's Animal Services Manager. Sorry we weren't able to get all the calls and emails and questions this hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.